Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware, in case any of you are not, of some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. So grab a pen and paper and get prepared to write down a website. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. I'm not a regular blogger, but when things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study. We've just started in Genesis chapter 47. Jacob and his family are now in Egypt, and Joseph went in and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers and their flocks and herds and all that they have come out of the land of Cana, and behold, they're in the land of Goshen." Joseph selected 5 men from among his brothers, and he presented them to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What's your occupation?" They said to Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and our fathers," meaning to tell them that's what we know. That's all we've ever done. It's a long tradition in our family. And they said to Pharaoh, "We have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks. The famine is severe in the land of Cana. Now, therefore, please let your servants live in the land of Goshen." Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is at your disposal." What a credit to Joseph. "Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them live in the land of Goshen," which was perfect for herdsmen. "And if you know of any capable men among them," I'm always looking for a few good men, just like the Marines, "then put them in charge of my livestock." And then, verse 7, Joseph brought his father Jacob. He presented him to Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. At last, enter Jacob. It was time to introduce the patriarch to the Pharaoh. Actually, Jacob was the greater of the two. You remember how with Melchizedek blessing Abraham in the book of Hebrews, the point is made, the lesser is blessed by the greater. Jacob's appearance was masterful. It was a good thing Jacob was not a woman, for Pharaoh's first question was, "How old are you?" Answer, "The years of my pilgrimage are 130. My years have been few and difficult, and they do not equal the years of the pilgrimage of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, respectively, 175 and 180 years. You notice that word, "the years of my pilgrimage and the pilgrimage of my fathers"? Now that is a perspective we all need to hang on to. We're aliens here. Our life is simply a transient passing through. Jacob understood that. We are not here to stay, and we should never get too rooted or live like we're here to stay. Then he blessed Pharaoh and exited stage left. The lesser, I say, was blessed by the greater. Only God knew that, however. But God's estimate is the only one that matters. Unwittingly, get this, and I do emphasize unwittingly, Pharaoh has been God's servant in taking care of God's people. God's temporal blessing is fitting in the case of Pharaoh as it was in the case of Darius in the days of Daniel. A blessing is the polar opposite of a curse. In history, those who bend their wills under the sovereign pressure of God's Spirit, under the pressure of the prophets or His preachers, we notice sometimes experience a certain level of God's favor and protection. Remember, this was not the Pharaoh who much later so mistreated Israel. That was a Pharaoh who did not remember Joseph after about 400 years. Well, verses 11 and 12 relate the settlement of Joseph's father and family in the best part of the land as Pharaoh directed. Pharaoh provisioned them with all they needed there in the district of Ramesses. He gave them everything they needed for their secure existence there. That name, Ramesses, just like the name the region of Zoan, is another but editorially updated name. The famous Ramesses II came along centuries later. In the time of Moses, our narrator, those updated names would better relate the two to Israel with that editorial help. All of this going on here in the narrative is a type or a pattern or a foreshadowing of the biblical truth that in the life of God's people there are, as a matter of chastening, we see it in Hebrews 12, rhythms in God's dealings with His people. By rhythms, I mean that we should expect, learn to expect, times of rigor followed by times of refreshing. This is an example. That cycle we see again and again and again in the life of God's chosen people. And we believers, at least I do, see it in our own Christian experience as well. From a Christian or New Testament point of view, you will notice in the germ of Joseph's provision, really God's provision, that provision was, quote, according to the number of children. Now that's a radical concept. Biblically, it is God's material model. You remember the Apostle Paul told the Corinthians that. I don't mean for you to have too little or them to have too much, but a kind of equality. God's material plan is that each have enough or sufficient. It's never God's idea to have believers setting on a corrupting surplus. The rich ought to share with those who have need. And there are among us the rich. Most believers are not rich. They never were. But God always appoints some. But they're never just to pile it up like Croesus. That principle, according to the number of their children, we see more specifically elucidated in the New Testament. Now listen carefully. Those whom God blesses with much ought to share with those who have less or have insufficient means. See 2 Corinthians 8:13 through 15. Folks, this is not Marxism. I call it Christian economics. That is where the capitalistic profit motive, Christian economics, is transformed to a work ethic driven by the desire to make a profit on labor, not just to supply the needs of myself and my family, but, as in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28, that we may, by labor, have surplus to share with those in need. This concept of what I call Christian economics is so radical that most in our capitalistic society, not even believers, ever give the notion much of a thought. Well, we ought to. We ought to, like Joseph, apportion resources to each according to the need. Now, the mechanics of that I haven't worked out, but that's an ideal. Joseph wasn't trying to make everybody in his family rich so that they could lounge around in the best of the pasture lands in Goshen for the rest of their lives. But that phrase, according to the number of their children, that phrase suggests that his intent was that a family who had been for 2 years experiencing extreme insufficiency for themselves and their livestock, that now they might be blessed with sufficiency, but sufficiency in due measure, in fair measure. according to the size of their households and the number of their mouths to feed. I hate socialism. I hate Marxism. You should too. They've never worked. They're always terribly unsuccessful. Look around our world today. Look at Venezuela. It didn't work in Russia. It's never worked anywhere, really. And oftentimes, it ends up bloody. Some of the places where it's supposed to work don't really work as well as advertised. And it won't work. Those economic systems won't work. They won't work for one reason, because of the nature of man. People who propose these things believe in the perfectibility of man, and they believe if they just get their hands on the levers of government, they can make it work. But unfortunately, it's contrary to human nature, it's contrary to their own nature. And eventually, they will be corrupt too, and they will be greedy, and they'll provide for themselves. They will not provide for the regular folks. It's just the way it goes down. Capitalism is not a great system because of the nature of man, but it's the best system, given the nature of man, that we know of. But among us Christians, where there are born-again hearts, not perfect hearts, but born-again hearts, that have the Spirit of Christ and the love of Christ in us, well, we can do better among ourselves in taking care of our own poor. Well, in verses 13 through 14, now the narrator Moses turns to track the worsening effects of the famine in Egypt over the next 5 years. Egypt and Canaan are wasted because of it. But due to Joseph's foresight, and that was owing to divine revelation and the wisdom God had given Joseph, plenty of grain had been stored up in the cities of Egypt against this crisis. Though the people could no longer produce crops for themselves, what they could do is buy from the grain stores to supply their own bread. You will notice there is no mention here of any provision for handouts. The big reason for that is Pharaoh and his court would not be running for re-election. There is a time, of course, for simple charity, but that course ought to be avoided as long as necessary, and for two reasons. There may be other reasons, but these two at least. It costs the recipients their dignity, and every time it turns them into resentful people. I grew up in the belly of Appalachia, in the middle of the coal fields. A lot of wonderful people. But I saw what dole can do to people. Secondly, once on the dole, those receiving it will always expect it. That's not in every case, of course. But I think we all recognize that tendency, at least if we've lived where that has been a prominent feature of the welfare system. The Proverbs state, the compassion of the wicked is cruel, and it is. That's the sort of compassion offered by the welfare state, and it does more damage than good. You will notice, by the way, that the politicians who push it most tend to be the very ones who are the last to set up and relieve others from the stores of their own vast wealth. They insist, I'm talking about the politicians, that the government, meaning Mr. Average, subsidize these giveaways. Then they rail at the capitalists who keep all their money for themselves. What appalling hypocrites. Well, verses 15 through 17, as time progressed, the effects of the catastrophic famine became more and more perilous, even with a sufficient grain supply. The problem was their money supply was finally exhausted. What next? Barter. They would bring to Pharaoh their livestock, meaning horses, sheep, goats, cattle, donkeys, in exchange for food supplies. Given the unrelenting famine, even this measure was not sustainable forever. In verses 18 and 19, another year passes. Although on the 5 remaining years' timeline, we're not certain how deep we are into that measure. In any event, the people came to the government, meaning they came to Joseph, who was, for all intents and purposes, the COO, the chief operating officer. They explain, once again, their awful plight. Their money is long since gone. Now all their livestock has been sold to Pharaoh. The only thing the Egyptians have left is nothing, quote, except our bodies and our land. Obviously, they did not want to perish. So, the hungry public proposes that in exchange for grain stored in the granaries, they proposed, not Joseph, they proposed that Pharaoh, Joseph would be the executor, buy both their bodies and their properties. They offer to sell themselves. They made the offer. Nobody made them slaves. They offer to sell themselves to the king in order to survive. So give us seed so that we may live and not die, and that the land may not become desolate. Give us seed is a phrase that no one seems to comment on, but I take it that the seed must come from the grain which they did not have in their own possession, and therefore could not cultivate from whatever water for irrigation may have been left in the mighty Nile River. In verse 20, all of this is forcing Joseph, as a chief administrator of Egypt, to come up with the most sustainable economic reforms in a time of epic, unprecedented crisis. As in the movie Shogun, a character says, "Foul times require foul measures." In this case, extreme measures, we would rather say. Though this sounds, to the modern ear, harsh, it was in the situation beneficial. For now, their food supply, all important to the people, was Pharaoh's responsibility. Modern readers find it difficult to regard Joseph's measures as benevolent. They look to us like exploitation of the destitute, who are, by force, that is, by force of circumstances, in a position where they have to sell or mortgage their animals, land, and their freedom in order just to stay alive. But Joseph, the cunning agent, makes the most of their plight to enrich the crown. But this contemporary take is to misread the account's intentions. The Old Testament law itself, which comes later, does not envisage the destitute simply being bailed out by the more well-to-do. Rather, if possible, the members of the family should help their destitute relatives, just as in principle Joseph did, by buying their land and employing them as slaves, Leviticus 25:13-55. This was viewed as a great act of charity, for as the Egyptians say to Joseph, "Not you're exploiting us." Thankfully, they say to Joseph, "You have saved our lives." Chapter 47, verse 25. It is within this historical context that Joseph's actions must be judged. When an Israelite fell on hard times and was no longer economically viable, there was a provision made in the law for such unfortunates to do a similar thing: sell their property and themselves as temporary serfs to someone else until the year of Jubilee happened every 50 years. At that time, both property and freedom would be restored. I'm pausing so long over this point, you may have wondered, because skeptical biblical scholars, under the sway of a so-called progressive mindset, which takes it for granted that the old ways are always worse, and in the assumed evolution of human thinking, the progressive mindset says the new ways are always better. These skeptical biblical scholars are forever sharpshooting things like this in the biblical narratives. And they make Joseph really one of the bad guys, exploiting and oppressing the poor and the weak for the good of those at the top of the food chain. Nobody in those days ever thought of economic reformation on the basis of wild-eyed 20th century socialism, not as far as I know, and I do know a little about history. If you know anything about modern socialism, its schemes, you know, as I said earlier, they have proved, to my knowledge, an unmitigated disaster. And generally, they result eventually in totalitarianism, wherever that system has been implemented. But at least economic disaster. Think of all the modern Marxist states and the bloody revolutions which have imposed them. So, let no commentators of that mindset criticize the sagacity, the wisdom, the prudence of Joseph. In his day, his system pleased not only Pharaoh, but it pleased the people. Remember, they said, "Man, you've saved our lives." You don't see them complaining about his measures. They're not running around in Egypt beating their breast and victimizing themselves as the oppressed under the boot of Pharaoh and Joseph. They were the boots on the ground, and they thank Joseph for saving their lives, we've noticed. It was, after all, the foresight of the monarchy that saved the people and the country through Joseph. His plan, his foreknowledge through God of what was going to happen. Through the whole catastrophe, two things were crucial. One, that the lives of the people be saved. And two, that the monarchy remain robust as a defense against political predators on the edge of the empire. How to accomplish that in this threatening circumstance? Wisely, Joseph chose the best options available to him in the day. The solution now, since the people had sacrificed everything for their food supply, was in behalf of Pharaoh to buy all the property and all these people, meaning the people by their own choice, lacking any means of subsistence, voluntarily sell themselves into servitude, sort of on the feudal system model of the Middle Ages in Europe. For a livelihood, they would cultivate, plant, and harvest. They would keep 4/5 for themselves, and they would give 1/5 of the harvest to Pharaoh, essentially a 20% tax, as we would count it today. If you count up all the taxes we Americans pay to our various government entities each year, including all those fees, which are just taxes by another name, the average person in the middle class carries a far greater tax burden than did these Egyptians. Was that arrangement equitable? Some would object. What economic system is equitable in this sinful world? I say again, does anyone think socialism is equitable? It never has been and always leads to enriching those who run the system and stiffing the rest, and it finally leads, in a very many cases, to totalitarianism. Is capitalism equitable? Pure capitalism is greed-based. At best, it's a meritocracy that punishes those with less capacity and less opportunity. Hey, breaking news. The world is not fair. It never has been after the fall of Adam. It never will be until the Lord comes again. All these desperate people wanted was a chance to honorably survive. They did not have grandiose materialistic dreams for themselves like modern Americans. Life for peoples of that time did not come freighted with such expectations. And ours today would probably be better off if ours did not either. How many times do we notice in the world at large how much happier populations with much less in the way of material things seem to be than our overfed, overstuffed, over-pampered Westerners? Life is not to be measured in terms of the abundance of things we possess, Jesus told us. There are a lot of forms of slavery much worse than the form this famine reduced the Egyptian population to. There is a way, and we have found it, to be relatively politically free individually, but to be slaves of our consumer appetites and our corrupt mores and our peer pressures. You see, underneath all this barking I'm talking about from skeptical scholars is a worldview hidden in the fog of argument. What is really important? Let no one lecture Joseph on his economic reforms unless they really believe that abundant life is found in personal freedom. And all of us, by the way, have less and less of that than we think or used to, and it's getting worse. Well, dear friends, thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We'll pick up there next time. Meanwhile, you have a good day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.